Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Shuang. If you have any technical difficulties, let us know and someone else can do it.
I'm not sure if it was me, but I think it's okay now. I've been paying attention. Yeah, thank you.
Because I've only been back on this continent for a week now, my sleep patterns are still a bit disrupted. And so, you know, sometimes I have a hard time falling asleep. And sometimes I fall asleep and then I wake up and I can't fall asleep again. Sometimes I sleep too late in the morning when I need to be up. So I'm still struggling with that. And that reminds me of, I notice that my behavior when I can't sleep, for example, reminds me of some how we approach our practice sometimes. Sometimes we say Zen practice is not difficult. There's a famous Zen poem that begins by saying that. The perfect way is not difficult. Sometimes we say it's difficult. And maybe we could look at it, there's kind of a basic misunderstanding about why it's difficult. It's not difficult to sit in Zazen. I mean, of course we have difficulty sometimes, it's painful sometimes, we change postures, but ultimately, even with our physical difficulties or our sleepiness or sluggishness or whatever, that's not the difficult part, actually. And sometimes we say, oh, it's difficult to attain enlightenment or to awaken. But that too is not the difficult part. I know you're all sitting there saying, how could she say that's not difficult? It seems so difficult for me. I'm just trying to explain to you the misunderstanding about what's difficult. So what is difficult is to keep our mind, I want to say pure, but I mean to maintain beginner's mind, this famous beginner's mind. That's what is really difficult. Everybody, when you first came to this practice, you didn't know anything really, or you thought you knew some things. And then you sat down and everything was new. You came to a sangha, you met a teacher, you met other people. You had experiences in meditation, you learned techniques. It was all new and fresh. And maybe it seemed difficult to you. And already then, when it started seeming difficult, you were moving away from the beginner's mind. You were judging it. You were expecting something. And I should say I or we. And it's not just you, it's all of us. And we start thinking that if we do this right, if we do it well, there will be some reward. We will arrive somewhere. We will attain something. We will become someone different than who we are. We will achieve something, we will become like some brilliant person, or we will feel good about ourselves, or other people will love us, or the teacher will think we're brilliant, or just, you know, I will accomplish whatever my goal is. You know, if my goal coming to this practice is to awaken enlightenment, even if I don't really know what that is, then that I think that I will be rewarded for all of my work, for all of my sitting here, doing this, going through all the koans, or, you know, hours of counting my breath, or just sitting there, watching my mind drift, that there will be some reward. And that's really difficult, that practice. Primarily, it's difficult because it will never happen. So there is no reward. That's the good news and the bad news, as I always say. And so I equate that with what I said about falling asleep. So it's like if I'm in my bed and I'm looking at the clock and saying, oh no, I should be sleeping now. If I really do this, if I really try hard enough, I will fall asleep. Or I should be sleeping now. This is the hour of the night when I normally should be sleeping. Or I have to wake up early in the morning, so I need to sleep now. And okay, I'm really gonna try to fall asleep. That's really difficult. I usually won't fall asleep then. However, I've discovered that if I can practice sleeping free of the idea that I need to sleep, or I will sleep, or this is how I will sleep, or this is how long I will sleep. If I just have no idea, no expectation, usually I fall asleep. Maybe not. You know, because there's something physiological going on when we have jet lag. So maybe not when I think or when I thought I should fall asleep, but I will fall asleep. Or I won't, but it will be okay because I don't have this expectation that I should fall asleep. So it's then in that case, it's not difficult to not fall asleep. Same thing applies to our practice. So when I say what's difficult is to keep our mind a beginner's mind, it's because very quickly we have ideas and we're looking for a reward, we're looking to accomplish, and then that changes everything about how we behave. So imagine, so I gave the example of sleep, but imagine that you are not striving to gain anything. You're not looking for any result in particular in your everyday life. So then if that's the case, how would you act? You know, if you're not looking to impress people, if you're not looking to make yourself feel better about yourself, if you're not looking to, you know, achieve some fantastic professional goal, build some, you know, realize some great dream, if you're not trying to gain something, then how do you act? How do we act? How do we take care of this moment just as it is then? I don't mean like in an abstract way. So concretely, how do you move then? If you're not looking to impress, if you're not looking to be someone else, if you're not looking to, you know, cultivate some quality in yourself, or some professional goal, how do you behave? How do you move? How do you talk? How do you hold your telephone? How do you open the door? or close the window? How do you make the bed? You know, sometimes we make the bed really quickly because we have something else to do. Or if we, you know, live with a partner where we make the bed for the 20th time because the partner never makes the bed and we're annoyed when we're making the bed. Or we're like really obsessed with making the bed perfectly and we take all this time doing it and it's never good enough. And we don't like the pillows we have and we wish we had new sheets. And anyway, this mattress is shit anyway. I need a new mattress and maybe I should move the bed and face the window instead. And pretty soon, you know, we're not even making the bed anymore. So, you know, that's something we can look at. If I'm not striving to be something else, if I'm already where I am and who I am, then how do I act? You know, and the Buddhist version of this would be, Dogen tells us, or we always say, you already are a Buddha. So if you're already a Buddha, act like one. And what does that mean? So the Buddha, so we could say, okay, a Buddha doesn't strive to be something else, doesn't try to impress or, you know, seek some amazing goal. A Buddha just does what a Buddha does. You could even say, in that case, the fruit of what we do is exactly the thing we're doing. So there's no other fruit. So you're making the bed, that's the fruit, is making the bed. You know, the Zen cliche is, you know, chopping wood, carrying water, cutting carrots, that is the fruit, even though carrots are a vegetable. That's the reward. Just doing what you're doing is it. But that's difficult to realize. When we say it's not difficult, it's because what is so difficult about doing just what we're doing? And yet, at the same time, in one of these great Zen paradoxes, it's extremely difficult to just do what we're doing. Not in the beginner's mind. The beginner's mind does not have trouble with that because it hasn't become clouded with knowing, with knowledge. You know, Suzuki's famous phrase was, in the beginner's mind, anything is possible. But in the expert's mind, very little is possible. So I think I was saying this last week even, or I don't know when, but something about, you know, that in the expert's mind, things are really narrow and limited. Whereas in the beginner's mind, whoosh, limitless. And so our practice is really just about how can we not lose that limitless meaning of beginner's mind? How can we cultivate that beginner's mind without becoming expert at it or something like that? That's what's so difficult. And sometimes we can look at, you know, everybody on this screen has different times when they started practicing and different levels of experience. And maybe we all look back at someone who is just beginning with envy sometimes. Or those of us who have, you know, I've got a lot of years of practice, I can look back at people who have less years of practice with envy And yet, I have as much potential for beginner's mind as anyone. You have as much potential as anyone to cultivate beginner's mind. You know, just like I think I say this a lot, but just the fact that you came here tonight, just that you want to be here tonight, is very valuable experience. You know, you probably came because you wanted to sit. You knew there would be a Dharma talk. And you wanted to participate. Beyond that, I'm not sure what your motives might have been. You know, I don't know if you had any clear thing of obtaining something or like, you know, what the result would be. So there's something really pure about the simple fact that you came. Even if you did have this thing where, okay, there's a talk, there will be other people, I can sit for half an hour and then listen to what she says. But can you just stay with that very pure motivation of coming, being here, wanting to be here? And like I've said over and over again, still, you know, after all of my, you know, years of practice, I still have the feeling I had when I was starting out and I was Gena Roshi's Jisha, and I would accompany her into the Zendo. And as the Jisha then, I was the last one in because she went ahead and I followed her with the incense stick. So I was the last one in the Zendo. I closed the door. I would close the door and I would look, and it was such a wonderful, wonderful moment. I thought to myself every time, they're here. They came. And it was such delight, such joy. And I still feel that way. Whether it's, you know, clicking on the button to open my Zoom, or whether it is rarely these days walking into the Zendo. And it doesn't matter who is there. And it doesn't matter how many people are there. It's not about numbers, you know, or particular people. It's the joy and the love of coming together, and the joy, the shared joy of this practice, you know, of wanting to do this together. That for me is still such a delight. Because I know how hard it is sometimes to do it, you know. Sometimes you think, oh, I'm not going to go. I'm too tired. Or especially when it involves going out, you know, now, especially in COVID times. But not even, you know, I know I can't think of recently I've had that feeling, but I know the feeling of thinking, oh yeah, But then when I do it, the same delight is there. It's like, oh, they're there. They came. And that doesn't make any sense, right? That, you know. But I'm not looking to make sense out of it. Zen makes no sense. But in the beginner's mind, everything is possible. That does make sense. And I think you all can relate to that. And in the expert's mind, there isn't much space. And I think you can probably relate to that too. Now, can we be an expert and have space? Yes. Can we let go of our expertise and manifest our expertise like a beginner? That that's, you know, that's real realization, I would say. That's, you know, that's when Maizumi Roshi would say that, you know, realizing oneness or awakening or whatever you want to call it was not really the hard part. Actualization is the hard part. So manifesting that in your life, actualizing the teachings and the experiences you've had, and then putting that into practice when you open a door, when you take a drink of water, when you tie your shoe, when you greet someone in the street, whatever you do. When you wash dishes, if you have children, when you change the diapers, when you when you make your bed, you know. And of course, we think that there are some things that are better than others, and some things that we should pay more attention to than others. But in fact, everything is important. So in beginner's mind, too, can we, you know, sometimes I look at my young kittens, right? And they're interested in everything. Like anything that moves or even not, anything new that appears, you know, a sock on the floor they think is an animal or something. And everything is new. It's great discovery. Well, the same thing can be true of us. Children too, you know, watching children grow, you see how everything is new. The same thing can be true for us. So when we say this practice is difficult, that's what we're talking about. It's difficult to maintain that pure, original mind, original beginner's mind, before all the ideas, before all the expectations, without seeking a reward. You know, with my kittens, I've, in order to teach them that they should come home, and we let them outside, as soon as they come in, we give them some kind of treat so that they will associate this good food with coming back in. And eventually I hope to get them so that they're not, it's not about a reward. They just want to come back in. With cats, it's a little different because part of the reason they want to come home is because they know that's where they get their food. They know it's warm there. They don't, it's much, much easier than living out there in the streets. So at the same time, I don't plan to give them a reward forever. So we can give ourselves some kinds of reward. You know, we can say, okay, I have this objective to sit every day or, you know, twice a week for 10 minutes. And then I'm not saying that's giving yourself a reward, but it's saying, oh, it's limiting it. It's saying, okay, this is what I'll do. You know, your reward tonight was you sat for half an hour and then there was a Dharma talk. Although it's not really a reward. If we think of it, what's a reward about it, you know? It's just what it is. So you set your clock, sit for 10 minutes, and then it rings, and then that's it, you know? It's not like it's some great moment when the bell rings so that you can stop sitting. It's just what it is. And then you can stand up and go into the world and do your everyday activities. and appreciate, bring that, you know, if you have experienced some sense of oneness in your practice, can we, you know, cultivate that feeling of oneness with all things, all of the mundane activities of our life, by paying careful attention to them? Careful attention meaning beginner's mind attention. And not thinking we should be doing something else, or we should be doing it a certain way. Now, I'm telling you this by making it sound like it's, you know, obvious or easy, but I've learned this through many long hours and years of practicing it. You know, as I've said, thinking sometimes that it was so unfair that I had children and I couldn't be practicing like the people who didn't have children. And someone pointing out to me that, well, taking care of the children was pretty important. You know, why was I thinking that was more important? Sitting in the Zendo was more important than taking care of the children. When I realized that, that was life-changing for me and for my children, I'm assuming. No, I'm not even assuming, I know it. So, when we say it's a difficult practice, you know, in this kind of classic Zen jargon, we could say it's difficult because it's not difficult. You know, some kind of thing that nobody can understand. It's true that, but at the same time, we can say that it's not difficult when we can let go of our idea of how it should be. Then it becomes very easy. Not that we don't still have difficulties, but difficulties are still easy. You know, if you can read Dogen, and it's really not easy to read Dogen, but this is pretty much what he's saying in all of his texts. And I'm not at all a big reader of Dogen. But I did read you know, a BD, a bande dessinée, you know, comic book version of Dogen's life. It was Japanese, actually, written by a Zen monk, and then translated into French and presented like a manga. You know, so it's actually it's three volumes, but I have it in one volume, and it's pretty good, actually. You know, the drawings are fabulous. The rakusus look like our rakusus. And, you know, it's a good kind of overview of Dogen's life and what his, how he came to have such a deep, practice and a deep appreciation for life, I think. And then how he transmitted it to others. And what I found inspiring particularly, I think, was that he he lost his parents when he never knew his father. And his mother died when he was quite young. So he was raised by his grandparents. And they sent him, his grandfather did not want him to go into a monastery. They wanted him to be a high government official, like the other men in his family had been. And he, at a very young age, decided that he wanted to go to a monastery. So he did, went to a monastery and became a monk, and but was not satisfied with, he became a full monk and he in Japan, and he had a teacher who gave him, basically gave him transmission, but said that he couldn't take him any farther. That if Dogen, and Dogen still had deep questions, and he said, if you want to know more, you know, I'm going to China for some reason, and you can come with me if you want to, and you should go to China. So they made the long, difficult travel to China. And when they got to China, Dogen was not allowed off the boat to go to the monastery, because his, first of all, his teacher wanted to go ahead and tell the monastery that he was coming. So he did, and the monastery was, you know, like 3 days walk away from the boat. So Dogen had to wait on the boat. When his teacher got to the monastery, they didn't want to let Dogen in because he had not taken the vows as the Chinese thought that he should take vows. And so he was rejected because he didn't measure up to their standards. After a few months, his teacher managed to convince them. Meanwhile, Dogen is waiting on the boat all this time and has no idea what's going on. His teacher comes back, gets him, brings him there. They let him in the monastery, but as a novice, although he is fully ordained monk, and he doesn't understand why. So every step of the way, he's being rejected for pure formalities, things that have to do with the form, that have nothing to do with his desire to practice, his depth of realization, his real search for meaning, for his questioning. And I found that inspiring. I didn't know that about Dogen. Because we always think of him as being, you know, like this perfect Soto Zen thing, and Soto Zen monasteries are so strict. You have to be just like Dogen, and you know, some of them, if you sit in a chair, you have to sit in the hallway, and or you have to sit behind a curtain. And if you don't have the proper posture, they come and, you know, tell you you're not sitting right, and hierarchy is so important. And I thought, wait, you know, that was not what Dogen was about, actually. And it wasn't. But as with anything, we lose touch with beginner's mind and create all kinds of stuff, right? That has nothing to do with the beginner's mind, the origin of it all, and Dogen's own quest, his own seeking. So Dogen is actually a good example of beginner's mind, too. He was constantly, constantly seeking, looking into, seeing what was appropriate for any moment. And he applied the same deep philosophical stuff that he talks about that it's hard to understand, being time and things like that. He also did stuff that was just really concrete about, in the kitchen, how to organize things. On the posture, how to sit, how to breathe, really practical stuff. So he was not just about this, you know, deep esoteric philosophical stuff. He was really about the everyday life. With the very basic notion of practice, free of an idea of a reward, not striving to be someone or be somewhere else, and appreciate the fruit of this very moment, which is this very moment, whatever it is. So that's a lot of words. Questions? Comments? Anything else if anyone wants to say something? The floor is open. Seo?
Only to say that reminds me to when I read the Communist Manifest in bande dessinée aussi. Capitalism, the Marx Manifest. It was a big book with so many things, and I couldn't read that. And one day I found a bande dessinée comic book, and it was my way also.
Yeah.
When you talked about difficult, and the simple things are so difficult, just to be with your breath. But when we do the four vows, yeah, the sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Then we are talking about very difficult things, actually, I think. To have it... seems so endless, so yeah, big, yeah, delusions to put an end to them. A task that never ends, yeah.
Yes, it's true that we do see it that way. Although, could we see it as when we say sentient beings are numberless, I vow to see them, or kind of like free them, make it better, or actually instead of save, either see them or free them. The way that I experience that is that sentient beings are numberless, which means every single person who I meet is to be seen. Can I, you know, it's like that famous story of the starfish on the beach, of, you know, the little girl, there's hundreds of starfish, and the little girl's taking them one by one and putting them in the ocean. And the adult tells her it's stupid. She'll never save them all. She said, yeah, but for the one that I'm putting in the water, it makes all the difference in the world. And so, and that's kind of the same thing with our vows. It's just this one, just this sentient being. But that means every sentient being, everyone we meet. But it, you know, it's true. I'm thinking about Jan's question, and the idea of endless, numberless, know, boundless, unsurpassable, you know, it does seem so big and so impossible. And maybe we feel like, well, where do we even start? And what does it mean reality is boundless, you know? And usually when we're coming to it from that, we think of these words, boundless, endless, numberless. Our mind is thinking of that as a size, like something that's measurable, or something that's not measurable, but we come to it with our mind of measures, and so we can't get our head around it because it doesn't fit our notion of measuring. That's why I say, if we can bring it back to just this very moment. So in this very moment, reality is boundless. So everything in this very moment is reality. Every phenomenon. In many translations, in many Zen schools, it's translated as the Dharma gates are boundless, meaning there's, you know, just everything is a Dharma gate. I think we talked about this once already here. So in this very moment, you know, so without looking beyond this moment, what is it now? Who's the sentient being right here? What's reality right here? What's the Buddha way right here? What's the delusions right here?
Hello. What you were saying and about what Jan was saying made me think that it seems that it's, don't think about it. Don't think about a project that, you know, it's endless. It's not a project. Just as you said, and just do it. Give yourself to it. It's a nowness. Now, this one. Yeah, it's what comes to me. Don't think about it. It's numberless, and I love that. Yeah, it's this.
And yet when we look around and we see, you know, all of the refugees and all of the guns and all of the horror that we're imposing on our planet, and disease, suffering. It's not easy, you know, to just say, no project, because we feel like we want to do something, you know, and we don't know what to do. So I think it's Pema Chodron, one of Pema Chodron's books, which is Start Where You Are, which is really, that's it, start where you are. On the night of 9/11 in 2001, when we were all just, you know, horrified, stupefied, even over here, you know, I wasn't in America, but, and my 13-year-old daughter was panicked and thinking World War III was starting, and terrified that, you know, every time she heard a well, there were no planes, but every time she heard a noise, she thought, you know, there was going to be a plane that would crash into our building or something. And I had no answers. You know, it was so big and so unknown. I didn't know what to say. You know, what was I going to say? No, everything is all right. I didn't know everything was all right in the sense of dealing with a 13-year-old child who's terrified. And usually it's the mother who is supposed to do all the comforting, right? And so what I did, I just happened to be participating in a Zen peacemaker retreat that weekend at Dana. I was not living in Dana at the time. I was living in an apartment in Paris, but no, it wasn't a weekend. It was a workshop during the week. Anyway, I guess maybe because of my practice and because I'd been in that workshop for a few days, I just listened to her. And I shared with her, it was almost like we were doing a talking circle, although it wasn't formally. She expressed what she was saying. I listened, I received it, and I expressed what I was feeling. I didn't go into details about, well, I'm scared too, because that's not really what a child needs to hear. But I shared with her that this was something that we didn't know. But I felt that it wasn't going to happen to her. It wasn't going to happen here. But basically I just listened. And I realized that it was not until the next day when I came back to the workshop and we did a circle about how everyone had experienced it. Some people were staying at the house and they had television at the time and they had watched news that night. I didn't have a television. Internet was very primitive. I mean, there was internet, but there wasn't continuous news on the internet. You had to call up the telephone to get the internet connection, and, you know. Anyway, so we did a circle. And as the circle was going around, and I listened to everyone, and I realized how healing that was, and how peaceful that was, I realized that I had responded to the situation as best I could with my daughter the night before. Just listened. In the face of this immense horror, you know, watching people jump out of the 100th floor, you know, just the horror of it, and just listening. And then as we worked during that day, you know, it emerged that we became familiar with the suffering of the people who had done that. That you would not do an act like that if you were not hurting in some way. If you had not been abused by, you know, an invading power, if you had not been, you know, crushed by something, you wouldn't crush other people if you had not been crushed. And so there was great compassion that came up. And I realized that with my daughter, it was the same thing, that I connected with her, with my own fear, not knowing, anxiety. And that helped me to better listen to her and receive hers. If I had denied my own, I would probably have tried to deny hers and done like parents do. Oh, it's nothing, it's nothing. Have a piece of candy, as people do with children. They fall. In French, it's c'est rien, c'est rien. I didn't do that. So that's when I say that when meet the moment and come to it. So come to it with beginner's mind, without getting caught up in, I have to do something. I have to behave in a certain way. I have to do a specific thing. Just listen. Just listen. and then respond. Listen to yourself, listen to your heart, but also listen to the other. Listen to the circumstances. So if we come back full circle, that's difficult in the expert's mind. But it's not difficult for the beginner. You know, in a sense, 9/11 was such a huge thing. It shook so much that for, you know, a bright shining moment, it was easy for us all to listen to each other. You know, the headline on Le Monde that day, which was, "We are all American." You know, that's like this, you know, quintessential French newspaper, and we know how the French are about being French and not being American, you know, and the headline was that day, "We are all American." There was this, you know, there was this moment. Of course, beginner's mind quickly dissipated and became a bunch of experts. And we know where that took us. So, almost out of time. If anyone would like to add something. Now I wish we could do a circle and hear what everyone did on 9/11. See how it was for everyone. It was 20 years ago, so how was it? Mm-hmm. Another time. Actually, my daughter was not 13. It was 20 years ago. She was 12. Christine?
Yeah, just quickly. I was a student and driving with somebody from my home. I had been home for the weekend, I think. And we were driving back to our university city. And it was on the radio. And I had no television at that time. And so, well, I heard it, but I just couldn't imagine it, you know? And I still remember it was only 2 or 3 days later that in my someone who lived with me had a television, and then I saw some pictures and I said, you know, I only realized when I saw that. Before it was just some words. I mean, yeah, it was horrible, but I couldn't get the immensity of it. So, yeah. And I'm really happy to be here tonight with you. It's the holiday, so I don't sing.
Well, I'm happy you could be here.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, shall we do the four vows?